We don't think about Mongolia very often when we look at the Korean Peninsula, but the relationship between Korea and Mongolia is inextricable. It was the transition of power from the Mongol Yuan to the Ming Dynasty in the 14th century that prompted the regime change in the Korean Peninsula that established the Joseon Dynasty. And in the 20th century, it was the Japanese Empire's plans to take control of resources in not only northern China, but also Mongolia, that prompted transformative but also deeply costly economic changes in Korea. And today, when President Moon Jae-in speaks about using North Korea as a land bridge to connect the economic opportunities in Eurasia, Mongolia is a major part of that vision. But where is Mongolia at this point in time? Are they in a place to reciprocate Seoul's vision? Our guest today explains Mongolia's foreign policy outlook today and where the Korean Peninsula fits in. With no further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yong Kwon, and this is Korean Context. Dr. Alicia Campi is with us today. Among Mongolia watchers, she requires no introductions. She is the former president of the Mongolian Society and adjunct professor within the Asia program at Johns Hopkins SAIS. A veteran of the U.S. State Department Foreign Service, Dr. Campi has published over 100 articles and book chapters on contemporary Chinese, Mongolian, and Eurasian issues. And her latest book, Mongolia's Foreign Policy, Navigating a Changing World, was just published by Lion Reiner. Thank you for being with us here today, Dr. Campi.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
You've written previously about Mongolia's foreign policy and domestic politics and its history, specifically the ties that Mongolia maintains with the United States, Russia, and China. What prompted you to write a new volume in Mongolia's foreign policy?
I have been an eyewitness to many of the changes and the democratic and free enterprise transition periods that Mongolia has experienced, and that some of my views and experiences, if they were not written down, would be lost. And that would be unfortunate, because what outsiders to the Mongolian experience tend to do when they don't understand what's happening in Mongolia is to criticize or find an explanation that comes from their own cultural viewpoint. And many of these explanations are very critical of Mongolia and of the Mongolian people. And I do not believe that is the correct way to analyze things. So I decided it was important for someone to write a book who had been there with Mongolia when there were protests in the streets against the communist government, and then stayed with Mongolian experiences through the past almost 30 years.
In your most recent volume, you cover Mongolia, as you mentioned, from 1990s forward, and you mentioned that Mongolia occupies a very particular space in terms of its success in the post-Soviet time period compared to, say, other Eastern European countries or North Korea or Vietnam. Could you touch on Mongolia's special trajectory?
You have to understand Mongolian actions, events, and perspective by starting with the reality of where it geographically is located. And for many centuries, Mongolians landlocked geographical location on a high mountain plateau at the northern end of the Himalayas was a barrier for Mongolian integration to the Asian world. And Mongolians were not understood. The mobile lifestyle of Mongolians was far different than the agricultural sedentary lifestyle of its neighbors around Asia. And so the interaction during those many centuries was mostly a hostile interaction between peoples with two different civilizational and economic lifestyles. And it resulted in a form of interaction that was invasion and then expulsion of Mongols back to their homeland and reinvasion. With the last 300-400 years, Mongolia was weaker economically and militarily, and therefore under Manchu Chinese domination for 300 years. And then in the beginning of the 20th century, the Soviet Union replaced the influence of the Manchu Chinese dynasty. And both of these great powers saw reasons to keep Mongolia's and its landlocked status as isolated as possible from the rest of Eurasia and from their peoples because they had that history of interaction with Mongolia, which was very militaristic and in many ways very negative. So Mongolia during the 20th century was consigned to a backwater status. Its views were not consulted, even though it was able to retain its independence compared to other ethnic groups that were absorbed into the Soviet Union. Mongolia was allowed to stay independent and pursue its own different lifestyle. And this lack of connection with Asia, which was a great detriment during most of the 20th century, in the post-Soviet world that emerged, the fact that Mongolia wasn't considered really a normal Asian nation and also had not such an equal status among Northeast Asian or East Asian communities was at first a negative because people didn't know how to dialogue with Mongolians. But later, under some specially knowledgeable and creative presidents in Mongolia during the democratic era, that Mongolia's lack of attachment to any one particular regional group now has been key to why other superpowers in the region, such as the United States and Japan, and nowadays with Korean Peninsula issues, South Korea, it can be a bridge because it's seen as non-threatening, as a country that can deal with all countries within its region and really in the world. And it is not attached to ideological or political views, which are barriers towards its communication with countries with very different ideologies and civilizational experiences. And so it can be utilized in dialogues, diplomatic dialogues, and in trying to construct a regional architecture for Northeast Asia and the greater Asian region, which are some of the challenges now we have in the post-Cold War era in the 21st century.
A couple of years ago, Mongolia really stood out in the international community as one of the fastest growing emerging markets, riding on the boom in mineral exports. Recent years, because of the global economic slowdown, that number has decreased, and also Mongolian policymakers are becoming more cognizant of the dependent relationship that they're having with China as a result of huge Chinese consumption of Mongolian mineral resources. As you mentioned, Mongolians have time and time again overcome these challenges created by their endowment. How is Mongolia dealing with this dependent relationship, both on their mineral exports and also their dependent relationship with China today?
I found it very curious as a person who was actually in Mongolia when the country was totally dependent economically, politically, military on Russia, Soviet Union, and its successor Russia, to the extent of 93% of its economy. And it very well understood, all the policymakers understood, at the collapse of the communist system, that they had to avoid being completely monopolized by their southern border neighbor, China, if they were to become a democratic, transparent, and more balanced free market economy. And all the foreign advisors and donors who came in to help Mongolia during the 1990s with the difficult economic situation that existed during the transition, everybody understood the danger and said, try to avoid the monopoly with China. And despite all of this knowledge, all of this concern, in 10 years, China became the main trading partner and totally took over Mongolian investment and monopolizes its trade, a pattern that's consisted now for 20 years. So again, I said to myself, It's one thing if you make these mistakes or if you make mistakes developing your resource minerals and because you didn't know, you were uninformed. This is not what happened to Mongolia. Mongolians themselves were concerned and very sensitive to the China issue. They also sent people in committees around the world to study the Chilean development case, the Norway development case. How do we develop resources without falling into the Dutch disease, without a strong legal regime to stop corruption? They did all the right things. They had much advice from Westerners and from other countries, and yet they did not avoid the resource boom, which was followed by the resource crash. So this is an example, I think, of Mongolia listening to the advice of Westerners and other countries, which was not appropriate for the Mongolia situation because the Mongolian economy is not a sedentary agriculture economy that was well integrated as a commercial system into its region. And so the advice that was given many times was the exact wrong prescription to develop a balanced economy, and in effect pushed Mongolia into the arms of Chinese monopoly. And so this has usually been blamed on Mongolia, but I, in the book, show very clearly with donor assistance policies and the advice of donors from Japanese to the Americans to the Europeans was the mistake of these advisors who came in knowing other kinds of societies that were much more similar to their societies, like a Vietnam that had an agricultural base and an industrial base. Mongolia doesn't have normal agriculture. Its industrial base, totally fictitious, set up, and not at all self-sustaining. And the reason for the failures and the mistakes were in large measure because Mongolia listened to Western advice, and the Western advice was not appropriate. And so we have been spending now, both as friends of Mongolia and the Mongolian policymakers themselves, have seen that the advice that they get from the outside superpowers and economic powers at times is not appropriate. And they have now a vibrant popular movement which is criticizing some of these decisions which are made in Ulaanbaatar at the federal government level, particularly in the mining sector, which were step-by-step imposed by ideas that came from outsiders on how to develop these sectors in a multilateral setting. And the local herdsmen who are living in the places where the mines are were cut out of the decision-making, cut out of the profit, and therefore have, in a democratic manner, in this new Mongolia that's risen now, are the ones who stood up to their own policymakers and said, wait a minute, we object to this. This is not working. It's very interesting because especially Americans think you make mistakes because you don't have enough information. And my book shows Mongolia was given information and because of its Soviet experience was used to a pattern of don't question the superpower, the rich country's information. You just follow their advice. And some cases they had to do it because their advice was tied to money. And Mongolia was so desperately poor during the transition. But then we have, especially in this decade, Mongolian leaders who realized, tied to money or not, these policies aren't working for us. And so we have got to think very carefully about what advice to accept and what can hurt us more than help us.
One of the things that you mentioned in the book is Mongolia is seeking to overcome some of the challenges through something that you call in your book a wolf strategy. Could you go in depth on what a wolf strategy is and how perhaps other Northeast Asian countries fit into Mongolia's wolf strategy?
I first want to start by saying unlike some of the criticism of IMF and Western donor policies that came out of the 1990s from Africa and Latin America, a key difference is how Mongolia reacts to policies that in the end are filled with negativity. They are not a society that will directly and publicly confront and complain and criticize about advice which move them in the wrong direction. And this is one of the reasons why they can diplomatically be the bridge between North Korea and South Korea, between the United States and North Korea, between maybe Iran and UN authorities, because although they have experienced the negative side of this Western advice in the post-Cold War era, they do not, in a strident way, complain and publicize externally their doubts and their criticisms. And so they're seen as a country that can teach, but it doesn't preach. And this is something Mongolia is now telling Western authorities, including the United States administration in Japan, why it has experiences that could be valuable for Kyrgyzstan, for Afghanistan, for Vietnam, both in democratic transition as well as free enterprise transition. In fact, this Mongol way, which I call the wolf strategy, I think if one understands it and embraces it, one can forecast Mongolian future behavior on a whole host of issues, including foreign policy and foreign economic policy. So what is the wolf strategy? When you look at Mongolian strategy for how they view the world and the outsiders who live in the same region as them, is first of all, they see themselves as unique. They are not part of the Sinocentric world. They do not have the experience of the Confucian values. So each individual believes they have the ability and must have the ability to take care of themselves and do not expect other people, especially non-related people, to take care of them, like their ruler, like their leader. So this independence of action makes them extremely flexible and, from an outsider's point of view, perhaps disloyal. They can change their loyalties according to the needs and the circumstances. They also can survive poor, landlocked, not integrated with the rest of the Asian peoples if they have to, but they also have the experience time and time again, as we also know very clearly from the Mongol Empire, of moving together in larger groups, working in different kinds of organizations, whether it's the UN organization, whether it's ASEAN or other political or economic related groups, in order to find their own benefit for themselves. So now when we're talking about like Asian supergrids or improving transportation rail links so that Mongolia is a transit country, an economical transit country between Russia and China or between South Korea and Central Asian republics, Mongolia immediately can understand the benefit and change its behavior so it can link up with different partners that it sees at the time are advantageous to them. And as soon as these partners are not to Mongolia's advantage, then they step back and can act independently from their own agenda and what they perceive as their best interests. Which is why when, for example, Mongolia runs into trouble where it doesn't follow certain IMF rules or its parliament has a user-unfriendly mining law and foreign direct investment recedes, instead of bending the Mongols to the will of the outside greater powers or the international community, Mongolia hunkers down and says, well, I guess we're not going to have any electricity or a new railroad this year or for the next 5 years. But, well, we never had electricity. We never had that railroad spur. We can live without it. And that's why they have this unique way of what we would say is enduring maybe the unendurable. Whether this is always appropriate for a modern state, this kind of thinking, can be argued. But nevertheless, it's in the minds of the people and engages the policymakers in making decisions which, at least from the outsider's point of view, look to be one step forward, half step back, unstable, things like this. But in fact, from a Mongol point of view, has a validity and a rationale.
Now, you've been a veteran U.S. diplomat, but of course, I was hoping that you could perhaps put yourself in the shoes of perhaps the South Korean foreign ministry. As you mentioned, South Korea has been quite interested in Mongolia, and because they're looking at potentially using Mongolia as a transit point to not just to Central Asia and its resources there, but also to Europe and the rest of the Eurasian landmass. As South Korea pursues this economic engagement, they're also looking for international partners who can actualize the current administration's dream of having a stable Korean peninsula through peace and denuclearization of North Korea. Of course, Mongolia is a partner in this process because of Mongolia's historic relationship with North Korea through their shared experiences in communism and also the support that Mongolia gave to North Korea after the Korean War. Are there things that you'd recommend Korean policymakers to keep in mind as they try to engage Mongolia for their economic and geopolitical and diplomatic efforts?
I think one of the interesting stories of Mongolian foreign relations is the expectation gap between Mongols and South Koreans. We didn't have an official diplomatic relationship with an economic relationship until 1990. When the communist government in Mongolia fell. So although Mongolia had relationship with other capitalist advanced Asian nations like Japan and even the United States, earlier than this, it was slow to open official ties with South Korea. But it understood in the 1990s that South Korea was quite a rich society, a vibrant business community, and was rising rapidly in its economic development and importance throughout the Northeast Asia region. So in 1990, the Mongolian government had very high expectations for Korean investment, and they thought they understood South Korea because of their association since the late 1940s with North Korea. South Korea, on the other hand, when they came into Mongolia in the 1990s, they also were very optimistic about the relationship because they kept saying, we are the same people with the same blue spot. And they thought, these people and their heritage, dating back to Genghis Khan, has a connection with us. And these people are like us. In reality, both sides have been bitterly disappointed. The Mongols and the rest of the world had no way to predict the Asian financial crisis that paralyzed investment opportunities and the flow of investment from Japan and South Korea and other nations in the region. That took a major amount of currency out of potentially being invested in Mongolian resources, number one. So Mongolia, while very interested in forging these ties with South Korea, was disappointed both in Japan and Korea during the 1990s for their actual investment. Both countries, Japan and South Korea, were very generous with foreign assistance. But if we move from dependency, we have to have investment. And the investment didn't come in large measure because of outside conditions in the international economy that were not the fault of Mongolia or of South Korea per se. Now, South Korea, as part of its assistance programs and its changing demographics, needed labor to work in its own manufacturing institutions. And so it was willing to give foreign assistance, and it was also willing for Mongols to come and work in Korean factories. But it became disappointed in what it felt was the ungrateful behavior of Mongolians, even the ones who were within the South Korean homeland area, and who were protesting and behaving in ways which, from a South Korean point of view, were not conducive to stability within the manufacturing unit or in the society. So why did this happen? This happened because we often say when we're analyzing Asian societies that Koreans, particularly the South Koreans, are the most Confucian of all the Asian societies, which means hierarchical. And you have to wait your turn, follow management and the direction of people who are superior to you, know how to behave well in the position you are in. This is a completely different tradition for Mongols who are not Confucian. No young person will accept, I have to stay and wait for a certain opportunity or for a certain position because I'm young. The Mongol tradition is, tomorrow we could have a terrible cold or we could have a terrible drought. I could be dead tomorrow. So grab whatever you can today. Nobody waits their turn. Korea, because of its history, is also a team-oriented country, like Confucian societies are. Mongolians saw no benefit to teams. You have to make the decision about life and death for you and your animals today. You can't wait for help. Maybe you can work with others, but you don't expect the help of others. So Mongols do not work well in teams. They can appear ungrateful. Just because you've given me a job doesn't mean I'm going to accept your working conditions. I'm going to be quiet. So these two countries, which had such high expectations for each other, actually had a civilizational clash. And both sides have been disappointed. Yet the Mongolian position geographically as the cheapest route to other very lucrative economic customers for South Korean goods remains. Mongolians really have excellent minerals, which if we could solve some of the transportation blockages, are minerals really needed by South Korea. And Mongolia can really help with North Korean communication and facilitate perhaps in the training of North Koreans and the integration into the world marketplace because, as I said, they can teach but do not preach.
That's it for our episode today. Many thanks to Dr. Alicia Campy. You can find her new book, Mongolia's Foreign Policy, Navigating a Changing World, on Amazon and many other online booksellers. And if you have time, please rate us and leave us a comment on your local podcast platform. We really appreciate it. If you have any questions, please tweet at us at KoreaEconInst. You can also find us on Facebook. And please visit us on keia.org to see all of our upcoming events and new research. See you next week.